Blog Talk Radio.
Time to start another one, another edition of the Provocative Talk, where three gentlemen explore the male perspective on love, life, and relationships. You know, and most of the time, if not all the time, we seek an honest self-evaluation, and I love the fact that we're not shying away from things that need to be said. We don't walk away from that. I'm your host, Mark Elliott, soon to be joined by Mr. DeMaurice and Mr. Charles. And we're moving to some topics, as we usually do. We've been doing this for a little over 4 or 5 years. A while ago, we were doing it for 90 minutes, and we shrunk it down. I'm sorry, we were doing it for 2 hours, and we shrunk it down to 90 minutes. And every now and then, I say this, and when we first started this, Mr. DeMaurice said to me, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours? I'll just say this, man. For the last 4 to 5 years, Mr. DeMaurice, we have found a lot to talk about. And we're going to talk some more this evening, man. It's time we get together and do some talking. How you feeling?
Feeling great, man. They can't stop us from talking, can they?
No. I think some people may want to, brother, but
they might want to, but they can't stop it.
Yeah, they may want to, man. But you know, we've been talking for a long time. We're gonna find some things to talk about in a little bit as well. Last show we did, man, was interesting because last show, we were talking about Kamala Harris, and you deviated, pivoted a little bit. I should say a little bit, man. You took a sharp right, and you unloaded on the man that sits in the White House currently, soon to vacate the White House. But I came across a stat today that was real interesting, and it surprised me in a sense, and it may surprise you, but I wanted to get your feedback on it. And kind of talk about it just a little bit. It came out, or has come out, and it was in a newspaper locally. Actually, I should work for this newspaper years ago. It's a black newspaper. I did sales for them years ago. But there's their head on the front page of their head newspaper. I mean, head article, headline article. It states that black men, 12% of black men, voted for the current president this past election. And that's down, you figure, they look at the percentages that Obama had and Hillary Clinton. And black women basically stayed consistent. But there was a good portion, I'm not going to say a good portion, there was a slight portion of black men that chose to pull the lever for him. And there was a decent amount of Latino men that voted for him also. Now, in saying that, your vote is your vote. You know, that's, you know, one of the good things about this country. You can vote for if you want to. You know, no one says you have to be legislated to vote, Republican, Democrat, or anything of that nature. But it kind of makes you wonder when you realize that same 12% of men for the past, let's say, 12 years voted Democrat. And for some reason or reasons, they flipped and voted Republican this time around. Hearing that information, Mr. DeMaurice, you know, what jumps out at you, sir?
How disinformation is really taken as gospel to some people, because I had to cut off some people. And there were black men who kept sending me disinformation from different sites, different news stories about the virus, about the elections, about the presidential candidates. And I remember a couple of them, I said, you know, quit sending me this stuff because, you know, it's basically BS. Your sources aren't really kind of solid sources, and this is propaganda. And I guess they maybe didn't hear what I had to say or didn't think I was serious about, you know, the message I sent them back. And I wound up just blocking them or deleting them off my phone list or any platform that I have. Because, you know, if the disinformation can seep into people's conscious and they kind of vote a certain way or think a certain way, then that's some powerful stuff. You know, if somebody who could lie to you every day to the point where you start believing the lies, you know, that's some very powerful stuff. So I don't want that seeping into my subconscious. So maybe they're not aware of what's going on. Maybe they're not aware of the person that they're following, they're voting for. Maybe they're doing it for money or tax reasons or some selfish reasons. I don't know. I really don't care. But is it surprising to me? No, not really, because people are people, and you never know what motivates people to do what they do. But I couldn't in good conscience be associated or want to get that disinformation or be around people who think so much differently than I do that it will be a productive kind of conversation or a debate on trying to convince them to be on my side. If they're going to that point where they're voting for, they're voting against their self-interest and voting against what represents them or the people that they look like, then I really don't have any patience for folks like that. And so I'm not surprised. We've seen that in all of our history, man. I'm pretty sure when Harriet Tubman was trying to do the Underground Railroad, you had some Negroes like, oh no, you better not do that, because Master been real good to us, and we might as well stay where we, you know, stay put. So, I you know, in this day and age, you would think that people have more information, more solid information, more truthful information, that they'll let that information guide them to the right decisions. But it doesn't. It doesn't. And for me, I made it a point a long time ago not to try to carry folks or try to spend a lot of time convincing folks different, because it's too much time wasted, and I ain't got enough strength. And I do have enough strength, but I'm not going to use my strength to try to carry somebody or try to convince somebody of a stance that they have and how it could be hurting them if they can't see it themselves.
Uniformity is damn near impossible. So, with that being said, you can't expect, I wouldn't expect all of us to think, walk the same path, feel the same. And you brought some very good points even about back in the days of Harriet Truman. I'm sure there was people that totally looked the other way. They won't be part of it. And it's hard to get all of us to kind of think and feel the same thing at one time. But I look at this a little different in a sense. And this is something we haven't spent time talking about. And maybe in the future we will. This one thing I'm going to mention a little bit, because I think the vote of the 12%, I think a good percentage of the 12% that voted was a rebellion vote, where they were rebelling against Biden for voting for the crime bill years ago. And you know, they looked at Kamala Harris. She was a prosecutor. And they looked at her, and they were saying, you know, she prosecuted a lot of people that look like us. And it was interesting in the story that I read today. They talked to one cat, and he basically, that's what he came across with. He was like, he didn't vote for either one. He voted for the Green Party, but he said that, you know, that a lot of brothers are still mad at that. They're misinformed, and they're thinking that. And I don't want to spend time this particular edition of the show talking about the vote that happened years ago. And we may never talk about it, but I mean, that vote, not the vote, the crime bill. But I wanted to just focus more on the 12%, because, you know, here again, you could choose, but a vote of rebellion, what, you know, I'm just happy they voted. Let me say that too. But it's like, what are you really trying to achieve? And even with that crime bill itself, people act like it was an African-American bill. And I'm always, you know, raising an eyebrow when we align crime with us, like crime is meant for us and it's our destiny. But when the mass public itself says that, we take issue with it. Mr. Charles, I'm going to get you on this one, Ms. and Sarah. Welcome to what we're doing. I was speaking to Ms. DeReese earlier, and I said that the last election that took place, 12% of black men chose to vote Republican. And out of that 12%, the past 12 years or maybe previous year, they kind of pulled the lever for Democrat. And they have the right to do so. But hearing that number and what has taken place, what are your thoughts, sir?
I think part of it, too, is a lot of it has – my thoughts start with economics and money. It just does. And I think that we primarily sometimes collectively, especially us as black men, we would love to have everybody on our side, everybody, not saying we all think that way, but it's like, wow, sometimes we think, like, how in the hell could you go against or something that kind of represents us with a party that may be or a candidate that may be more in our favor? And I get that and I receive that, but I mean, one thing that always stays pertinent in my mind, money does a lot of crazy things to people. And I when I heard that number, as you mentioned, I think a lot of it had to do with money. I really do. Because I think when people get into a position where they think they're doing well, because one thing we don't talk about often is, particularly amongst African Americans, finances. Some people do well. Like, you know, you think back to Reagan years and whatnot, some people did real well because that's what it was. But they allow the money oftentimes to dictate how they feel. And coming back, knowing with the tax situation, as you mentioned, with Biden, and it might have been part of the crime bill too, but to me, I think the majority of that was money driven. And we think I think a lot of times we just think that We as a collective group, even us that have money, are going to go one way. And I think we're sadly mistaken by that. I just do, because I think at the end of the day, when it comes down to it, people are about survival. And it's about, if I had to save my money and keep my money, and that means I had to go against you, then collectively I'm sorry, but I need my money. I think that is so much more pertinent than we want to really believe and accept.
Very good point. Very good point. Shifting gears a little bit, doing something a little different. Thank you, too, for bringing what you always do to any particular topic, bringing different views and bringing something strong. Appreciate it. Standing on their shoulders that elevate us, Black Panther star Deanna Guerrero, I might be saying her last name incorrectly. If I do, hey, try to forgive me, will play the role of Shirley Chisholm in an upcoming movie. And our last show, Mr. Charles, you brought up Shirley Chisholm. I'm glad you did. So I'm going to turn it over to you, and I want you to enlighten us on one Shirley Anita Chisholm, please.
Sure. Shirley Anita St. Hill Chisholm was the first African-American woman in Congress in 1968 and the first woman in African-American to seek the nomination for president of the United States from one of the two major political parties back in 1972. Her motto and the title of her autobiography, Unbossed and Unbought, illustrates her outspoken advocacy for women and minorities during her 7 terms in the House of Representatives. She was born in Brooklyn, New York, on November 30th, 1924. She was the oldest of 4 daughters to immigrant parents from Barbados. She went to college, of course, and although her professors encouraged her to consider a political career, she replied that she faced a double handicap as being both black and female. She initially worked as a nursery school teacher. 1949, she got married to Conrad Chisholm, a private investigator. She went on to earn a master's from Columbia University in early childhood education. And by 1960, she was a consultant to New York City Division of Daycare. She was always aware of racial and gender inequality. She joined local chapters of the League of Women Voters, the National Association of Advancement of Colored People, the Urban League, and the Democratic Party Club in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. In 1964, she ran for and became the second African-American in the New York State Legislature. In 1968, she sought and won a seat in Congress. And there it was where Fighting Shirley introduced more than 50 pieces of legislation and championed racial and gender equality. the plight of the poor, and ending the Vietnam War. She was a co-founder of the National Women's Political Caucus in 1971, and in 1977 became the first black woman and second woman ever to serve on a powerful House Rules Committee. Discrimination followed Chisholm's quest for the 1972 Democratic Party presidential nomination. She was blocked from participating in televised primary debates, and after taking legal action, was permitted to make just one speech. Shirley Chisholm retired from Congress in 1983. She passed away in 2005. Of her legacy, Chisholm said, "I want to be remembered as a woman who dared to be a catalyst of change." Shirley Chisholm.
Thank you, sir. I want to take us back mentally to the time when all this is happening, because a lot of her work was done probably during the Civil Rights Movement, which we know nothing about. And you figure that she just fought through that and persevered. And knocking nothing that we see take place now in current day times that folks are achieving, and we salute them and we honor them. But think about her dedication, what she went up against, what she had to deal with. And like you said, she was barred from participating in the debate. Think about that for a second. Imagine you're walking in this room right now. You're planning on doing something in this current day time, and they just bar you from doing it because of the color of your skin. Well, what would you do? What would you feel? That was commonplace back then. Commonplace in this country. And sometimes we forget that. We live like it didn't happen. In reality, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, I remember 1972. And I think most of us, I was 10 in 1972. So, you know, it wasn't that super, super long ago. So when I say we are standing on their shoulders, we should never forget that. Because there was something that burned inside of her. All the things you heard Mr. Charles listed that she did accomplish. Others wanted her to go, and she didn't want to go in that direction. There was something that burned inside of her to get that done and take that on. I want to take a little break. We come back, we change gears. But, you know, one thing I want to say before we go to break, what's burning inside of you? Because we saw what was burning inside of her. What is really burning inside of you? Stop and think about fishing in a sense. And to me, fishing is one of those things that carries a lot of different terms to it. Because most people think of fishing is you throwing a cast out there, getting a boat, you're pulling in some porgies, some blues, bass, whatever. I've done a little bit of that in the past in my life and enjoyed it when it took place. But I think that in our lives, I know us three as men, we have someone that taught us how to fish in life terms. And I think we should spend some time going back there and paying gratitude and tribute to those individuals. So I'm coming to you first, Mr. DeMaurice. If you can pick someone that taught you how to fish, not even close to wars, nowhere around the water, but they taught you how to fish, who would that someone be?
Oh, man, there have been so many people who've taught me how to do that. And I was trying to think of someone I haven't mentioned on the show before, but I have to go back. Of course, I could say my dad, my Uncle Fred, but I'm going to spend my time talking about Rosa Lee Woods, who taught me how to fish and taught me a lot of things that I still do to this day. When I lived with her and I was in high school, I remember getting a job working at a local McDonald's and you know, staying out late and working and things of that sort. And one of the things that she sat down and told me is like, you know, you live in this household, you eat the food, you use electricity, you wash your clothes and all that. You got to put some money towards the household. You like to talk on the phone and all that other stuff. And I didn't mind that at all, because the way she broke it down was, you're going to be a man one day, and you're going to have to learn how to take care of your responsibilities. And that means cooking for yourself. That means taking care of yourself, paying bills, things of that sort. And this is where it starts. And so her and my mom really were on me about that when we all lived together. But when I lived with her and it was just she and I alone, when she broke it down and explained it to me, because when you tell a teenager, hey, I need some of your check, sometimes adults don't explain to you why they're asking you that. I don't think she needed the money or needed anything that I was bringing in the household. She wanted to make sure that wherever I lived, that I had a sense of responsibility to pay it back and to and it wasn't much she was asking for. So and I would often find myself giving her a little bit more than what she was asking for, because I felt that sense of responsibility. And so that carried over into in manhood, you know, being responsible, taking care of yourself, taught me how to clean, to cook, to sew. I remember coming home from going back to North Carolina to visit my mom and dad. And as soon as my foot hit the front door with my suitcase, my mom would tell me to put my suitcase down and let's go to the store shopping for Thanksgiving food. And so we would get all the Thanksgiving food, and she would sit in the kitchen and watch me cook it. So watch me cook everything. So and talk. And I love that. I miss that, because she would catch me up on things. We would sit and laugh and talk, and she would be there, and I watch your pot, watch that temperature on there, watch this, that, the other, and, you know, just making sure I had it right, because, you know, she wanted to eat too. So, but, yeah, Rosa Lee Woods, you know, a lot of people don't have the opportunity to spend time with their grandparents as much as I did with her. But she taught me a lot about life, not only the Bible, but life itself and how to look at things. And we would have heated debates over a lot of stuff, but we would always laugh and chuckle about something that she had said. Or she would end the conversation or end the debate with something really funny, so that we wouldn't be sore at each other after the debate was done. So, and she taught me how to agree to disagree sometimes with people. And someone who didn't go past the sixth grade in school, and I say this, and I tell my students this all the time, that's the smartest woman that I've ever met in my entire life, or the smartest woman I know of. Because someone who didn't go through college and high school and all that other stuff, that woman has so much wisdom that you knew it was sent from above to give her words to give to you to help you conduct your life. So, yeah, I want to dedicate my time to saying she taught me how to fish.
Yeah, I could double down that. You and I share the same beautiful grandma, and what she did for you, she did for me, and did some other things. But I want to comment on something you said about the money, because, of course, my mother was her oldest child. And I remember the first time I got out of high school, my first job, and got paid. And Lee's grandma said that to you, you know, you got to pay for so-and-so, whatever the case may be. My mother didn't even say it. My mother was more gangster about it. And I remember my first check was, I think my first check back then was $250. But after cashing it and coming and driving home, mentally I got plans for $250. I mean, there's plans. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do this, whatever the case may be. So remember pulling into the backyard, parking the car, and I'm walking up the porch, and I'm up in the back door in like a hallway from the porch door to get to the back door. I didn't get halfway through that hallway for the back door just open. And my mother said to me, "Did you get paid today?" And she knew I did. Yes. She said, "Okay, give me the money."
Give it a loop.
You know. So my mother, reached in my pocket, took out, just got cash. I don't think I left the bank half an hour ago. She stood right in front of me and started counting. Bang, 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 bang. She took about 160, gave me back 80, and dared me to say something. And dared me to open my mouth. You know, of course, I didn't open my mouth. I'm going to take a little different path and to someone that taught me in a different way to fish, but really in a thinking way of fishing. It's my Uncle Curtis. And my Uncle Curtis, there's just different times throughout my life when I was younger, he would say some things that, from a male perspective, just it was always where I needed to be. You know, he'd one first who told me, you know, when you shake a man's hand, you look him in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
You look him square there in the eye. And you can read a lot when you're looking him in the eye, and it can say a lot to you. Also, he always expressed to me, you know, anyone that you spend any amount of time with, their life should be enriched in some form or fashion by knowing you. So there's a lot of little things he said like that that always kind of register and played a part in my life. So that's the gentleman that I don't get a chance to talk about too often, but want to basically pay tribute to him because, to me, he at that time, he represented what an uncle was supposed to be.
Cool.
And I remember one time there was a cat that did something, and I came home to grab something to go fight him with. The cat was older than me. He was younger. He was like, "No, Mark, if you're gonna go back out, you know, don't get a weapon. Just go back out and you gotta handle it without fighting with anything." I said, "All right." So I stormed back out the house to go fight. And he followed me. He followed me. We got there and the guy saw me coming and he walked up, and as I was getting ready to start fighting him, Uncle Kurt jumped in, and the guy apologized. And they apologized, and nothing took place. So, here again, he kind of, uncles, I don't know if we really have uncles like we used to or like we should. Because to me, uncles, especially in a male's life, man, should play a pivotal role in helping you as a young man grow up and kind of foster your thoughts, your thinking, and your behavior. But that's the word, and auntie too. I'm not taking nothing away from them. But auntie and uncle, really, you know, you very seldom hear those names even passed around anymore. You know, unless it's basically just to kind of say, you know, represent me in a sense. But outside of that, their point and their place, what they play in a person's life, to me, has lost its value, and it should be very valuable. Mr. Charles, who taught you how to fish, sir?
There's so many people that were connected, but it might get old, but I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about my dad. My dad was everything. I mean, considering that he raised me without my mom for a long time, trying to get things right, and I was the only child, my father was a mentor. He's my playmate, my friend. He's a little everything. But the one thing about it was, you know, some people thought because I was the only child, I was by myself, and he would spoil me. Now, he made sure I had what I needed and some things I wanted, but he also made sure that he would teach me lessons, and he wasn't going to baby me. So he let me make mistakes and fall down and do some things, and he would oftentimes, particularly as I got a little older, when I started becoming a teenager, he made certain to put me in situations that were very uncomfortable, and he wasn't going to save me. Like when he taught me how to drive a car. Which, as I said, made me drive a car. Anyway, but he was teaching me like he was doing me a favor. At 14, he says, all right, we're going to drive. I said, oh, great. Had a four-speed stick shift, driving the car in the parking lot. Did that for about a week or a little longer. I'm driving around the parking lot, got everything down. He said, all right, one day, turn out here. Turn to the street. I said, that's not part of the equation. Nah, you be all right, turn. So I turn, I'm driving, no problem. Come back. And one day he takes me out on a very busy street. And it's around rush hour traffic. Like, okay. And for some reason or another, I started to panic because there was a lot of people, a lot of noise, and the car cuts off. And then, of course, I try to start it, and it won't start. I'm asking him, please, to help me. I start, you know, getting really emotional. And he's like, do what I told you. People are at this point blowing the horn. And I'm like, oh, my God. They're blowing at me. All of this start coming on me. I'm like 14. I was like, man, this is horrible. And he says, I told you to do it. So I get mad, and I follow right in the protocol. Start the car, and I just start flying. They're, slow down, slow down. I said, no, you want me to drive this damn car? I'm driving. At 14. So that's who he was. And, you know, you had to learn how to pay bills. You had to do stuff that stuff he went through because he went to World War II at 16. So he was doing grown man stuff. You know, I thought I had a bad 16 years old. My father's on a Navy, on the ship, as a second-class gunner's mate, loading ammunition for war, bro. 16. So I'm sitting there going like, my life is nothing. But he made sure that I could do what I needed to do. Like the first time I drove, we were taking a trip to Illinois. I was like 16 then. And he was driving, drove to Illinois. Drove about an hour, he pulled over. They get up front. I'm like, excuse me? You're driving. I'm like, I never drove on the highway before. He said, I taught you how to drive, didn't I? Yes, sir. Well, he had company. So he gets back in the back seat and snuggles up with his company, closes his eyes. He looked at me like, drive off. I said, what? Well, I'm scared to death. Scared to death. He's like, you got it. You know what to do. Just stay in the right lane. Keep this position right here. And I drove for about an hour. He's like, all right, I'm going to take over now. I was like, well, gee, thanks a lot. Anyway, but those are the lessons. Lessons were kind of fast and furious and hard, but they were needed. And the one thing about it more than anything was when he needed to be mental and understanding, he was that too. Because you know I was very stubborn and hard-headed, and I got mad quick. So instead of saying things crazy to me, or he could have easily just slapped the hell out of me, which he did when I was younger, but he started teaching me things about using your brain and making sure that you had the intellect. And you guys mentioned, DeMaurice mentioned about your grandmother, her having a sixth-grade education. My dad had a tenth-grade education, formal education, but he was well-read. Well read. He knew everything about anything. You talk about it from the time in the seventh grade. He taught me how to. My dad was a baseball player. He didn't teach me how to play. He taught me how to play baseball and made me play the hardest part that I could ever find in the difficulty because of the competition. And then in basketball, I tried to learn how to play. I couldn't shoot the ball. My father taught me a little push shot. I learned how to perfect that. But it was just a premise of he always wanted to provide me with all the ammunition I needed to be successful in life. I'm not sure if he knew the future was going to be quick, or I would need that to grow up as a man fast when he left me, but just that factor. So, and my father was probably, my father was married a few times. And from the women of my stepmothers that I knew, none of them could outcook my father. None of them. My father could have been a pastry chef. That's how good his stuff was. You look at it. You ever seen a cake where you look at it and it's been with the swirls and somebody's basically decorated it so beautifully that you don't want to cut it. It was a showpiece. He said, you better cut that damn cake. That's why I make it. But those things like that go a long way because when you look back, even now to this point, I look at people and they shake their head, don't understand how I'm able to continue to persevere. I was like I said before, I was taught by the best. And I understand what's going on because there's nothing that he he didn't teach me, he didn't prepare me for. So now I just kind of look at that. And what I do more than anything now is if I run into younger people or somebody else that might be having an issue and I can provide assistance, I share that knowledge and passion. So that's what I talk about with that.
Mr. Charles, I know you were in the process of finishing up a book, man. Fill us in what's been going on and where you are with that, sir.
Yeah, it's been up and down, man. But God is so good because he knows when I wanted to lay down and relax, he throws people in my life. He throws things in my life to make me say, you can't do it. D. Maurice. Anyway, there's one of the few folks. And a few relatives and people just kind of give you ideas and push you along. So with that being said, I've had information that I've written down probably for like the last 10 years, little notes and things. And D. Maurice was probably the one person that made me look at this a different way because I'd never written a book before. And I kept telling him all this information, all the stories. I was like, yeah, man, this book is going to be this. I think it's going to be this. He said, you can't get all that in one book. I was like, what you talking about? He said, you got two books. I was like, what? And I started thinking that way. And once he said it to me and I continued to think about it, he was right. So anyway, I'm to the first book. I literally have chapters together right now. I have finished my first chapter, which is major for me. I think it's going to be 12 chapters in the book. It is major for me that I put the first pages together and the first chapter is finished. Now I need to continue to put the other thing. But the one thing that is key is I was able to come together, formulate the chapters, and now I can use all the information that I have and let the book basically write itself because I think it's already written for the most part. But now I have some uniformity, if you will, and I know where I'm going. So that's where we're at, and we'll keep pushing. Chapter one is done. We got 11 more to go, 11 more to massage, and hopefully we'll have something here shortly. At least I have something. So, D. Maurice, I think I might send you that first chapter, brother. I'm scared, but I think I'm going to send it to you.
Okay. I'm waiting for it.
I was scared, but I think I'm going to send it to you anyway.
No worries.
Good stuff, man. Very good stuff. Gentlemen, there was an NBA draft that took place, I think it was last Wednesday night, and I think most of us probably had a chance to kind of tune to watch it as we were, you know, avid sports fans around here. But anyway, Tyrese Maxey from the College of Kentucky was drafted by the Sixers, and his dad, Tyrone, when he was younger, always used to beat him in basketball when he was young, and he talked about it now. That kind of always pushed him. He would cry when his father would beat him. His father never let him win. No matter what he did, he always made sure he kind of felt the agony of defeat. And it may sound mean to some, but in essence, he was kind of teaching his son how to fish. And his son sees that now that he's kind of moved on into the NBA. I poured this on Wednesday night, and I wanted to kind of spend a little time talking about this in a sense. I noticed this during the draft, and I've seen this at the NFL Hall of Fame, plenty of times, man, plenty of times. You have guys in the NFL Hall of Fame where they're up there, they're talking, and they're going back and forth, and they might talk about their first wife or their first marriage or their first wife, and if they talk about her, the camera automatically finds her and goes on her, and she's a sister sitting there. And then they'll talk about their current wife, what she's doing in life, and the majority of time, majority of times, when they flash to the second wife, she's white. Most of the time, she's younger, but she's white. And then, coming back to the draft on NBA Wednesday night, a lot of the students or young men that were sitting with their parents, because it was done virtually, not the majority, but a good portion of them were coming from interracial couples. Again, the father was black and the mother would be white. So it's an interesting pattern, to say the least. You know, we tended to, if you look at it, the majority of times, I don't think I saw one on the draft night where it was reversed. The father might have been white and the mother might have been black. So here's a question to start this out with, Mr. DeMaurice. You know, does we notice this anymore, or is just kind of blended into society?
In a way, when you mentioned it last Wednesday, I never really kind of really thought about it, but it seems to be happening more. But it really kind of really jumped out at me when after we did the show, and I was sitting there watching it, and I think I texted you and Mr. Charles.
Yes, sir.
I said, is that a white woman with a kente cloth on? And Mr. Charles was on delay. I think I see things before he does, like maybe 10 to 20 seconds before he does. And I remember Mr. Charles saying, text me. He called me that night. He said, man, I had to text you. He said, because what are you talking about? Because I get a lot of that response. Like when I text people stuff, I'm like, what are you talking about? And so when I saw that, and it kind of like really, really stood out. So I'm thinking about it, and I said it that night that, you know, some of these folks are in circles where it's a more diverse population, or it's more Caucasian people around, or people of different ethnicities around that they're associating with. And I had to think about my own life, where I work at a school that is very diverse. It credits itself as being the most diverse school in the Midwest. And who I in constant contact with on a daily basis when we were on campus. And so I think sometimes, you know, when you maybe get to a higher social economic status, or you're getting into certain industries, you meet different people. And maybe these parents are, you know, meeting each other, and then they are, you know, having children that are biracial. You see it in the NFL. I'm sitting there watching Patrick Mahomes. Same situation. He has a black father, white mother. You have Kyler Murray, who is black and Korean. You know, so you're starting to see a lot of, as the world kind of gets smaller, you're seeing a lot of maybe interracial couples, you know, hooking up and having children and making that decision that, you know, they're going to raise their children as multicultural children. So, I think it's seeped into our subconscious where, you know, I don't kind of pay attention to it as much as I used to, maybe say 20 years ago, 30 years ago, because it's become, you've seen it in commercials, you see it in movies, you see it in all walks of life, and it's not a big deal, you know, that much anymore to me personally.
Yeah. Mr. Charles, we tend to notice this anymore. It's just something that, a kente cloth, you can't miss that.
Yeah, I mean, and white women don't do that. Black men who wear plaid, it doesn't go, and white women with kente cloth, it just doesn't match. Leave it alone. Don't do it. It don't match.
Before I come to you, Mr. Charles, Mr. DeMaurice, it doesn't say something about him to have her in a kente cloth. In essence,
he's accepted this woman as his queen, and she has accepted his culture, and that's what it said to me after I had thought, after, you know, the kind of shock of seeing that, like, whoa, you don't see that every day. But maybe it's to him, I've accepted her as my queen, and she's accepted that she is part of my tribe. And so this is what we do. This is how, you know, we celebrate, and you are a part of this. And so, you know, do I think any less of him? No. I mean, that's his choice, whoever people choose. And grandma taught me a long time ago, different strokes for different folks. And so, you know, whoever is with whoever, that's it.
Two questions coming at you, Mr. Charles. You know, you think any different of him? You know, you saw her with the kente cloth. He was dressed in garb, if I'm correct. If I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think any different of him? And do we notice this anymore?
No, I don't think any different of him because that's what he chooses to do. Everybody has a choice. You know, in my family, there's a few marriages that are, you know, two, you know, interracial marriages. So it's no big deal to me. I see it all the time, and I think we've accepted it a lot. But I will say this. I'm with DeMaurice on that Kente Claw because you don't see that often. And when I saw that, because I went back and I looked, and I said, what the hell? I looked, and they showed it. And the dress she had, okay, if you know anything about Kente Claw, the way the dress was made, it had to be deliberately made for her. It wasn't something you put off the rack. It's custom made, right. Because the way it was set up, and they had some, like, some strings that went around her neck, and it crossed back over, and had a strap or something in the back. I was like, damn, she took time to get this Kente Claw made for her. And then they rolled back to the young man when he was a young child, and the father was in his African garb, and mama had that Kente Claw on there too, matching right with him. And as DeMaurice said, he said, I'm not going no damn where. I'm with you. The hell with my family, the hell with whoever. I'm not going back. I'm here, and I'm staying. That's what it said to me. He's like, I'm making an announcement. I don't care what y'all believe. This is who I'm with. This is my king. And so I don't think today it's such a big deal. Some people might go, okay, but you got to get over that, man. You know, you used to be commonplace, like over in places like Europe and Germany or whatnot, but it's becoming more and more now today. And the youth are showing you they are not really up on it. It's us as we're the older ones now that had an issue. These young people, it's why the whole same thing with the protests. They're coming together for themselves, and we're just old fogies now. So we need to just be, if you don't like it, just be quiet and, you know, get your little Jell-O or pudding cup pop or cup and watch your TV program. Leave the kids alone. But I think that's what it is.
Yeah, I think to an extent we still notice it some. I do. It don't take a Kente cloth sometimes to notice it, but that definitely makes me stand out for. Ooh, and you're right, that dress was custom made. Someone put that together. Someone sat down, a Singer sewing machine, and put that together. But anyway, I remember years ago living in the Carolinas, and there was a town in North Carolina, Fayetteville, North Carolina. And they're going to change that town to Miss Raceville because the majority of the people that lived there, it was mixed. It just seemed that way. It just seemed like it was the capital of mixed relationships. And you would say to yourself, okay, North Carolina? You wouldn't think so. And then I've seen other places, man, where there's pockets of where mixed couples tend to just be. I mean, there's always spread around, but there's certain areas of this country, man, where there's just a hub of mixed couples, and they're living their lives. They're living their lives. I want to come back to you with this question, Mr. Charles, though, because most of the times it seems like when it's interracial, we see more black men with white women, are an Asian woman of that nature. Do it seem like, does it come across that black men are more willing to step outside their race and date as opposed to black women are willing to step outside of their race and date?
Wow. On the average, probably I would say yes, but I think there's a lot of, now in this modern day society, there are a lot of black women that feel comfortable as well. I think we just don't see them, right, as often. And I think that sometimes, I'm not saying they're hiding, but I think sometimes that they just keep going about their business, particularly like in the African-American community, where black men or African-American men, we just like, all right, come on, girl. You know, she's with us, she's with us. So I think that it depends on the individual, but I think more men are apt to showcase or have a person available in public. You see them more often, and I think that's why the numbers appear that way. And we as men probably just don't care because of that factor that once you make that decision, it's like you're going to catch hell one way or the other. It's going to be, why you with that white woman, you know, when you're leaving the sisters behind. So, well, y'all angry. So So you can get to a really big mess. So if I was you or somebody like that, I'd just stick to what I know. If that's who you want to be with, love them, and there's no need for explanation.
I'm going to come back to something you said that I want to double back on. Just don't care. That's a key point there. Mr. DeMaurice, does it seem like black men are more willing to go interracial than black women?
I think so. And I think that sometimes, I know with me, I know that more women that are a different race than me let themselves be known that they're more attracted to me than black women for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe that's the Chicago thing. I'm not sure. And it makes it easier to approach or to engage when you're like that, when you're always getting rejected. And when you're trying to engage with folks, it's always good to have someone that, you know, you don't have to work that hard to engage with or have a conversation with or find out if that person is interested in you. And I think that sometimes, and I'm not saying in all cases, but sometimes I think black women would probably get more ridiculed dating outside of their race more than black men will. Even though we'll get that friction from black women. But I think if black women really stepped out, they get, to me, it's almost like they get more criticized for doing that than black men. It's almost like it became a norm for black men, or okay, yeah, this is what they do. But for black women, from the family, from the community, it's like more friction. And I watch a show called The Last OG, and you can see the character Haddish, who marries a white man, in that you can see kind of the friction and pushback that she gets in that particular presentation, as opposed to a black male in other presentations that I see that date outside their race.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if the pushback and the criticism could be any more harsher than what black men I got over the years, bro. I will say that.
Mm.
I will say, it's not a Chicago thing when you said that they tend to make themselves more known, and they do on average. They do. They will make them, if they're interested, they let you know. There's no guessing. There is no playing hard to get. All of that stuff ceases. It just does. If they desire to be with you, desire to get to know you, you will know. There's nothing else about it. There's nothing. They're not afraid to approach. They're not hesitant to approach. They don't fear the rejection. And at times, they can be very bold about it. Very bold. I was saying to, when I said earlier about Mr. Charles, when he said about the not caring, I think what black men have basically thought, and you can say it's not caring, I think they realize that if they came across someone outside their race and they choose to be with, that they enjoy, they already know going in what they're going to put up with. So in a sense, they have not to care. They have to kind of feel like, you know what, I'm gonna do this. Hey, I got to turn a blind eye. I have to go with it, because more than likely, in some cases, it's not going to be received well. I think, and I'm going back to your point, Mr. Reese, about them getting it from the pushback. I this is something I've noticed over the years, in a sense. When a sister decides to date outside of a race, in a lot of circles, bro, they look at it as a step up. They just do. Why? You know, I can't necessarily say, but they look at it, if she made that decision, that she done gave all black men a chance, excuse me, and they failed her, whatever the case may be, and it's like a last resort, now she's stepping up. But they are slower, much slower than we are to step outside the race. And partly because, and this may not sound flattering, they're more dedicated to our race than a lot of black men are, bro. It's just what it is. They are more dedicated to the soul and the earthiness of our race when it comes to dating outside of their race. And they almost feel, I should say almost, they will feel like they're portraying the race to step outside of their race and date. And I think that has kept a lot of them from stepping outside of their race and dating outside of their race. So that's why I say that word of not caring gets to be tricky, because I think for a brother, if he comes across someone that he wants to move and engage in with and have conversation and date, he's not thinking on those terms. He's not. He's looking a lot of time what's to be gained, you know, and a lot of times he's flattered by the interest that's being shown from someone that he's not used to getting, he's used to getting interest from. And especially if a cat has lived his life, a portion of his life, and he has received interest from his own, when someone walks up and show interest that you know, kind of been seeking, and like you said, it's easier. It's easy for them to kind of roll with, but I think we don't stop and think about the, you know, go back and think, okay, am I doing a disservice? We decide to make that move. We decide to make it based on what we're feeling, what we're kind of hoping to gain. And I think for a lot of sisters, they'll spend the moment, they'll spend the time, and they will think, you know, and think it through. And I think based on the betrayal part, they might find it very difficult to do such. I just wanted to get your response to that, Mr. DeVries, and I'll come back to you, Mr. Charles.
I don't think it's necessarily, if you choose to date out your race, it's a betrayal to your own race. So me and you probably differ on that. I just think that you when you meet people.
No, what I said, I just want to be clear. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I didn't say it's betrayal. I said that's the way they may think. I'm speaking of how sisters may think. Yeah, so make sure you respond. You're responding correctly, bro.
That's awesome.
With that said, make sure you got the right question.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, people, you know, they find, you know, who they love and who they love. I think it's whether sisters feel betrayal or not from that they're going to be betraying the race, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's a situation where maybe they're not in those circles, that men can get into some of those circles that they can't get into, and to meet people of different races. I'm just not sure if it's a betrayal, because I think if the more people you're exposed to that is more diverse, I think it opens up the possibilities. And the reason why I say that is because, like I said, I teach at a very diverse school, and you'll talk to some of the people who have gone in with the attitude that I would only date this particular group of people, and then get exposed to a whole new group of people and spend some time with them. And then you start to see their preferences change based on the experiences they have with a new set of people. So there may be some credence to maybe some women feeling a betrayal, but I think there's a lot of other factors that could factor into why maybe black women are more hesitant in going into interracial relationships than black men.
Mr. Charles, is there any validity that they may feel that they're betraying their race by choosing to date outside of it?
I don't think so, because of the factor that, now we talking about the men or the women?
I'm talking about the women. The women may think so.
Okay. I think some may, because if you think about how hardcore things were when we kind of grew up, and even before us, that was really not something that you really naturally thought about, unless your family was very open, and that didn't reach mention. You had different experiences meeting different types of people. But if you didn't have those circles, then it was almost like But as women continue to grow in the way that they work, have different experiences, gain more power, and then, of course, evolve into other situations where they're expanding the audiences that they connect with, then I think at that point they're like, well, some may say, yes, I would love to be with a man of color, African-American man. But then after a while, it comes down to, I think, straight women saying, tired of being lonely, tired of being by myself. He was nice. He showed me like he cared and he showed interest. And I went for it because I've been waiting. You hear a lot of women, some women I know, have said, I was tired of waiting. I was waiting, trying to put myself in positions and to be with a man of color, and I just couldn't find somebody. So guy came up, and they went for it. And they, I think they just said, okay, now I'm going to deal, move forward and deal with whatever may come my way as far as so-called repercussions, if there are any. But this is who I'm going to be with.
Okay. Gentlemen, let's take a little short break. We'll come back. We'll see what type of questions Mr. Charles and Mr. Norris is going to give us with this edition of One Black Man Talk. Mr. Charles, Mark Elliott, Mr. DeMaurice. Trying to wait for some things need to be said. You know, we don't do that here. Yeah, we always kind of shoot for that honest self-evaluation. We all come together and form One Black Man Talk. Mr. Charles, I'll come to you first. Your question that you have for us, sir.
No doubt. I want to throw this at you. It's a little different, but I find it interesting. I'll throw a little sports thing at you. WNBA and women's basketball player Sue Bird, she called for equality with NBA, with the NBA, but not about equal pay. And I find that interesting because they had, there was a thing put out where they had put up a diagram or a graphic that shows her compared to LeBron James. They both played 17 years professionally. LeBron has 4 NBA championships. He has 4 WNBA championships. Her salary was $215,000 for the year 2020. LeBron's salary was $37.44 million. Her bonus for winning the finals was $11,356. LeBron's was $370,000. But the whole point of it that she said was she believes that they received, the WNBA that is, more exposure and more opportunity to talk to sponsors, then they should start to get paid the real money that they deserve. What do you feel about what that statement was made by her? No, it's a lot.
It's not a lot, man. Come on, man. You know what we do here. We chop it up. I think she's off the mark. I mean, you can look at the numbers. But where she's missing the 4 championships that she won, as opposed to 4 championships LeBron won, it's a vast difference. Meaning that men and women will focus in and watch LeBron. LeBron, you know, he came in with a story, and there's more audience for LeBron winning championships as opposed to Sue Bird. Sue Bird played up in Connecticut, so I know about her career. But what she has to realize, where there's numbers, there's more money. You don't have the numbers. So you can't justify the economic clout of LeBron making $37 million a year. So you have to understand, if LeBron is making $37 million a year, could you imagine what the NBA is making a year? So if you're making $215,000 a year, what do you think the WNBA is making a year? So where is that money coming from to balance it out? And just because advertisers decide to come in, that doesn't mean it's going to raise up people watching. The reality is, you know, and I get me wrong, I love the WNBA. I do. But the reality is, in this country as a whole, we are not accustomed to watching women play basketball. Now, playing on the college level is a different thing because you got that old collegiate I'm gonna pay attention. I'm gonna watch. I'm gonna listen to your school. That's it. But when you make it and you take it mainstream, people just aren't accustomed to watching women play basketball. And what she's not really factoring in is that it took the NBA years to get to where they are now, where they can afford to pay LeBron $37 million. I mean, the WNBA started out playing right away. It was on TV. And they played in – I remember going to – the first year, I remember going to watch the New York Liberty play the Houston Comet. It was sold out. Over 19,000 people in the Madison Square Garden. But they started right away playing on national TV and in the Garden. Years ago, when we were younger, the WNBA should be on tape delay. I think the championship game, if I'm not mistaken, when Magic Johnson came into the league, game seven, I think when he played that game, if I'm not, that game was played after. It was played, let's say, 8 o'clock Eastern time in the country, but the game was shown like 11 o'clock at night. So the NBA, when you look at it, has a foundation that has been built for years. The WNBA hasn't had that, and they may never achieve that because, here again, in this country, people aren't accustomed to watching women play basketball, and that right there may never balance itself out. Your response, Mr. DeMaurice?
It's basically simple mathematics and simple economics. And in mathematics, it just doesn't add up. The money, where are you going to get the money from to pay WNBA superstars or their, the counterparts to the NBA? And in economics, you learn that there's supply and demand, and there's just not a great demand for the WNBA. It's simple. And so if the demand was greater, then you would get paid. I mean, it's simple mathematics and economics. And so to try to make that comparison from a product that is not in great demand is kind of ludicrous, in lack of a better term, because and I said this back on the sports show, that the WNBA was kind of it was a disservice this summer, last summer. Because you had all the other sports happening at the same time, and nobody was really paying attention. Nobody could find you on the television. It didn't really matter if they even advertised the games, to be honest with you, or try to advertise it at the same rate as with football, basketball, baseball, whatever was going on. It just wasn't really gathering all that momentum in the summertime, and that was supposed to be the time for the WNBA. But it's a real problem with the WNBA. Maybe overseas, maybe they pay more attention to women's sports, but at women's sports, if you're not playing tennis in this country, you're really not going to be making a lot of money. The reason why female tennis players, and I'd rather watch female tennis players than the male tennis players, the reason why they can grab those million-dollar checks and all that other stuff. I never forget that sister who was a newcomer and won that check and looked at the check and had that face like, oh, my God, this is what I want. The reason why she can get that, because there's a demand for female tennis players like Sabrina, the sister from Japan and Haitian descent. There's a demand for them. And so I would say to Sue Bird, if I was in front of her, you know, it's about simple mathematics and supply and demand. It's economics. It's simple. The WNBA is not in demand in the American audience. Until you get that, you cannot stake your claim to money that's just not there for you to get.
Yeah. I'm a little surprised that's the route that she took. You know, I am. And I know she's probably frustrated with, you know, them not having the viewing audience of that nature, but I don't see her foundation here, and I would have thought she was different. And I'll say this before I come to you, Mr. Charles, here respond. The WNBA has got to realize you turn more people off than you turn them on with some of the things that you do as a league. And I'm not talking about the protests. I'm just being honest. With some of the gay things they want to get behind and stand behind, you turn some folks off. That's being honest. the average mother that's not gay is not going to want to sit down with her daughter and feel comfortable with some of that. So you, if you really want to kind of pull the Band-Aid off, be real about it. I mean, don't get me wrong. Some people are open, but this is still America. So you're playing a sport, for the most part, that's dominated by men. Dominated by men. And most people just aren't accustomed seeing you doing it. And then there's that sector that I just brought up. Mr. Charles, your response.
Yeah, I was, when I saw it, I was like, I think, you know, somebody put the graphic for her, put it up. She kind of responded to whatever was going on. But I think that I agree with what was said earlier about it being ludicrous to think you're going to make that kind of money. Because you people have to, the fans have to tune in, and you have, your game has to be respected like that. They are respected for what they do. But on the other hand, it's just like you said, supply and demand. It goes a long way. And I said it earlier before that I think the one thing they might have to do if they really want to make headway, if they up their money a little bit, if you really want to make a splash, I think that they have to cut back the number of teams and really start to stockpile these rosters with the best talent playing against one another, which really competitive. And I think it's going to make people watch. Now, that might not be needed for the primary audience, but for other people that you want to attract, then I think you would have to do that because people want to see it. You just don't want to turn on a game, and because somebody has Sue Bird, whoever else is playing with her, they play another team, they get beat by 25. They're like, well, where's the competition? And when you have a product that is the way that they're trying to market, every game has to be pretty much competitive. And I mean, that might mean young ladies might be losing jobs, have to go overseas, but if you want it to grow, I think that's the way you're going to have to go.
Yeah. Mr. Reese, your question, sir.
You kind of sparked this question. In the theme of, you know, I know the holidays are coming up, and often I have a lot of thoughts about family memories and things of that sort. A memory that you have with an uncle, and you made me think about a memory I have with Uncle Kurt, but a memory you have with an uncle that taught you some life lessons that you carry on to this day.
Let's see, man. I might do a lot of them now. Yeah, you will come back with this. Oh, let's see. Let's see what pops up. This is not a great memory, but it's something that came to me, man. My uncle Andrew, who was actually Uncle Kurt's brother, one day Uncle Andrew had some tough things he did in his life when he was married. He took some things and he kind of thought he was doing some things right with his family, and he was doing some things wrong. And it wasn't until after he got divorced one day and he was sitting at a table eating, and out of nowhere, he said to me, "Why would my father tell me some wrong things?" And I didn't have to ask any questions. He just started talking. He said that my father says some things to me, how to be a man, how to be a husband. And I listened, and he was wrong. And it hurt my feelings and my spirit because, you know, his father is my grandfather. And to realize the hurt that he's feeling, realize the hurt that he caused his family, because I've seen it in progress, you know, it says something. And it always, to me, even though he may not have been trying to have me get something out of it, but it said to me, you know, not that I didn't know it at the time, just because somebody plays a role in your life or someone you expect to really be in your corner or someone has a position or something or some name, don't take it for granted what they're saying and giving you has to be correct. You still have to use your own mind. You still have to factor in for yourself. You still have to weigh it and put it together yourself. And you still got to think about it. Just don't take that just because someone might be X, Y, Z, what they're doing is right for you. What they're saying to you is right for you. And that was full display, listening to him talk and go through it. And there's just no way he could have imagined his father's teaching what his father told him to do could have been wrong. Even when he's hearing it, probably when he was younger, you know, he's believing more in the person that's giving it to him than what is being said by the person. And I'll flip that to, I think now in current day life, man, if you look around at a lot of people, they're being led blind by people that are putting faith and trust in different sectors of life. They sit and wait for someone kind of tell them what to do, and they don't question it because who's saying it? And they believe it. And that is dangerous and sad. Your response, Mr. Charles.
Yeah, I would have to say probably my great uncle. My great uncle was my grandfather's brother, and it wasn't so much what he said, but it was through his actions. Because years ago, my dad's family's originally from Tallahassee, Florida, and my great uncle migrated from the South up to Ohio, and he put himself together, kind of worked real hard, did some high jobs until he was able to kind of start his own small business, and he eventually evolved to doing his own other small businesses, and he helped the rest of the immediate family who wanted to come from Florida migrate to Ohio because he thought it was a better way for them to live in the South. And one of the things he had, Morning, that he owned his own gun club. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, the gun club where you go and you shoot, clay pigeons and things like that. And it was really recognized where we lived. And he was like one of the few people that was established like that. And just that alone kind of let me know, even way back then, you could, and he had, you know, he would have a lot of the family, some of the family work at the gun club and whatnot. But he established himself, and he kept letting you know that you could be an entrepreneur no matter where you came from. So it always stuck out to me that no matter what the situation is, you can still be your own man and make your own money.
There it is. Mr. D. Reese, good question, man. I'm hoping that I gave something that was substantial, but let's hear yours, sir.
Yeah, it's a little light, but it does have some things to it. I was talking to Kurt, Uncle Kurt, maybe a couple of months ago. He's still the same old Kurt that I know and love. And one of the things about him, and I remember him staying with our family for a while, is that you do not tell Uncle Kurt what he can and cannot do. He had an accident, some time ago. And the doctors were telling him, no, you can't do this. And he was talking to me about it. It's like, man, I got my clothes on, and I got up. And I'm like, you haven't changed one bit. But I remember him being that uncle who kind of gave you advice, just like you said. But I remember there was a time where he wanted to date this young lady, or he wanted to take her on a date. And she had a sister, and she was taking care of her sister. She couldn't leave her sister behind. So he figured, hey, Don is around the same age, so we're going to have a double date. So, nephew, we're going out on a double date. And I'm like, you know, I hadn't had that much experience with girls and all that stuff. But he was like, just follow my lead. Just follow my lead. So Uncle Kurt had the lady up against the wall, and he was, you know, they were kissing. So I looked at him, looked at my little date, had her up against the wall doing the same thing, just following his lead at that particular time. So he is a character. Glad he's part of my life, but just living with him also, him talking about life, him talking about you know, his perspective on how they grew up and things of that sort, because grandma and granddaddy at that time, they were like one of the first black families to move to New Haven, Connecticut at that particular time. And the Woods brothers, they were kind of rough customers roaming the streets of New Haven. So everybody knew them. Everybody knew them. And if you got in any trouble and they said, oh, you Kurt's nephew? Oh, he's good. And getting to meet all his friends, him and Uncle Andrew, all the friends they used to run with. I don't know if you remember Mickey, Kurt's friends. Yeah. All those characters, mm-hmm. man, just being around them, man, taught you so much about life. And they were grooming you to be men, too. You know, they used to rough you up, and they wouldn't allow you to be any punks because they weren't punks running around New Haven. So, and then you had to keep that mantle up, that if you were part of this family, that you could throw those hands and you were somebody that you want to mess with at that particular time. So they looked out for us. And that was an interesting story you told about, you know, when he told you, hey, go out there and just handle your business. And the guy came up and apologized because the Woods boys were pretty rough characters back in the day. And they ain't take no stuff. When they say about preacher kids, yeah, it's true. When it came to those Woods boys.
Yeah, that is for sure, my brother. That is for sure. I'm going to come back to you if you have another question, Mr. Charles. If not, I'll throw one out there. But see if you have something else that you might have cooking, sir.
Well, I'm going to defer to you, my brother.
How about you, D-Reese? Anything else you got? How did I know he was going to say that? Anything else, Mr. D-Reese? Let's see if anything's percolating.
No, I mean, no, not really. It was going to be more political, and we don't have that much time to get into political conversations at this particular time. I'll save it for a different time.
Okay, cool. I wanted to venture into this because I listened to a podcast the other day. I kind of stumbled across it, and it was a podcast of Tamar Braxton and Monique speaking, and it was talking about Monique, for the most part, was talking about her relationship with her husband. And from that, we're going to talk about it. I'm going to bring it up in a future show, not this evening. But with that being said, I wanted to know, what do you two do? What do you listen to in your downtime when you're not basically focused, but you're trying to might decompress or you have some time to yourself? What do you find yourself listening to? Or maybe viewing on television, for that matter. I'll go to you first, Mr. Charles.
I have like different playlists, so I listen to music. But I like the music to decompress. There's gospel, there's a little hip hop, and then there's also like some old school funk or something. It depends on what the mood is and how I need to focus, because the gospel helps me to kind of calm down and really get into my thoughts, especially if I'm serious about something. I want to pull out some feelings. And then sometimes I'll listen to maybe some different podcasts, some people I think might have an interesting guest, but primarily the music. Music is key for me because the TV thing is like a delicacy for me. So I, when I want to decompress, I just want to like listen to some good music and just kind of go there.
A question about the gospel you listen to, because I do that quite a bit too. I have a list I listen to. But this is a question. It's just, you know, as you were saying that, it popped in my head, so I'm going to come back to you on it. I know for me sometimes, man, when I know what I'm playing, because my list, of course, I put together for my gospel list, but there's certain songs that I may have played. It could be a particular song sometimes, but there are sometimes certain songs that will come in rotation, and it may start to play, and based on that day or whatever, and it's for no one reason, man, that song can lead to emotional reaction. Is that something you experience also?
All the time, man. There's one song, yeah. and I really came back to it because Rance Allen, the great or vocalist, man, just passed away recently, and he sang a song that was originally made by James Cleveland. And it's called I Stood on the Banks of Jordan. and basically talks about somebody losing both their parents, and then you're left by yourself, you and the Lord. And that's what it's about. And every time I hear that song, I think about my situation. I think about other people. And I just think about all the people that have gone on. And, you know, the first you came back, you took my mother. You know, first you took my father, then you came back and took my mother. You took everything that was dear to me. I'm like, wow. Yeah. So, yeah, every time I hear that song, I'm almost close to tears, bro.
I hear you, man. Mr. DeMaurice, something that you find yourself that you use kind of decompress or do when you're not really focused about anything in particular?
Of course, music. Listen to jazz, hip-hop, R&B, whatever. I'm in the mood for at that particular time. Sometimes I'll binge watch on some shows. I just finished the show that I started, but it took a while for me to get back to The Watchmen. Last night, but most of the time is for me is reading, or writing for me. It's been more so reading now than the writing, because sometimes I don't want to get kind of set in a certain kind of mode where it sounds like I'm writing the same thing over and over again. So reading kind of helps me explore my mind a little bit to get kind of travel to different places and different times and different kind of ways of thinking that really helps me kind of decompress. And then, of course, this doesn't help me decompress, but just working out helps me kind of just get frustrations and get stress off me. And just working out and training does that too. And then there's a certain meditation that you do that I've learned within the last couple of years that's really helped out a lot with really kind of focusing and decompressing and getting back to the foundation.
John, we got 2 minutes to go. I want to come back to something you said about working out, because we all three do. But what do you do? And if you don't mind, you know, we'll kind of keep this kind of short. What do you do on those days when you don't even feel like working out, but you know you should? How do you get over that point?
Get up and do it anyway. Get up and do it anyway. And that's one of the things that my Sifu always said. You're going to get to times where you're going to feel like, man, I don't feel like doing this. Get up and do it anyway. Do it anyway, because you're going to feel much better after you do it. So when you get to those times, that's just kind of trying to keep you from your goals. That's the negativity. Power through it and do it anyway.
Mr. Charles, same thing for you, man, because we all feel this at times when it comes down to working out. How do you push yourself over the hump those days when it just don't seem like you should be doing it?
One of those days was today. Best thing to do for me, plugging them headphones, bro. Don't. That and hit the playlist. I'm ready. Yeah, that music is such a motivation that it's hard to just sit by idly. It's like, okay, I have a reason why. Let's move forward. I feel motivated. So yeah, music. Music is my salvation for a lot of things.
Yeah, I remember the phrase years ago, man. Just do it, and that's it, man. Sometimes, like you said, I'll plug in the headphones. I'm dead tired. You know what? It's got to get done. it's just got to get done. And with that being said, once you get started, once I get started, it tends to roll on. Gentlemen, we'll get together soon and do it again soon. But before we do that, we'll get together for the sports show. Thank you, too, for doing what you always do. This is Mark Elliott, Mr. Charles, Mr. DeMaurice. Together, we are One Black Man Talk. Thank you for giving us a listen.